Hello and welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast from The Lancet Haematology. It's March 2022 and I'm Emma Cookson. This month I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Gavin Perkins from the University of Warwick, UK, and Dr. Nicholas Crombie from Queen Elizabeth Hospital, Birmingham, UK, whose new research on the use of blood products for resuscitation in patients with trauma-related hemorrhagic shock receiving pre-hospital care is published in our issue this month. So, Gavin and Nick, thank you very much for joining me today. First, Nick, can you tell us about the background of the trial that you did, where you compared the use of blood products with saline in patients with trauma-related hemorrhagic shock, including why these products were being tested?
This all started back in 2011-2012, when the British military started bringing blood products forward from Camp Bastion to soldiers injured in the desert during operations. And it very quickly became apparent that they were getting more soldiers back to Camp Bastion having received blood products than they were previously. It was felt that with this major trauma, early replacement of blood products was improving their survival. Very quickly then translated into civilian practice, where one of the major UK air ambulances started carrying packed red cells for the same reasons. At the time, I was working with an air ambulance up in the Midlands and was coming under pressure to do the same. But I wasn't convinced by the biological plausibility of this, in so much as packed red cells, as we know, are fantastic for replacing red cells for anemia. But I didn't feel that it was the best volume to replace volume. So hypovolemia and traumatic injury. Added to that, constituents of red blood cells with high levels of potassium and glucose and citrate and so on, given rapidly, they exert quite a metabolic strain on the body that's already suffered a trauma. So although it was becoming very popular, I wasn't convinced that it was the right thing to do. And I and a few colleagues did a literature review, and found that there was almost no evidence at all, none of any quality, looking at pre-hospital blood products in trauma. And it was from there that the refill trial started. What we wanted to do was ascertain whether or not blood products given pre-hospitally conferred a survival benefit and improve the quality of resuscitation in patients. Because if it did, it should be universally available as a standard treatment. If it didn't, then it shouldn't be necessarily up to individual air ambulances to decide based on their charitable status whether or not they were going to carry it. I wanted to find a definitive answer, and that was where the trial came from.
Okay, great. Could you tell us a little bit more about the comparator group? So why was saline used as the standard of care, and how it kind of came about that that was the standard of care?
So saline has for a long time been the standard of care in UK and European and American civilian ambulance services. Obviously, putting blood products on every single frontline ambulance would be impossible in terms of the amount of blood products you'd have to supply and the logistics and the cold chain. So ambulances carry saline, and that is what trauma is treated with even today. If you are treated by a standard ambulance as opposed to an enhanced care team on an air ambulance. So that was the standard of care, and we were testing that against pre-hospital blood products. We chose red blood cells and lyoplasm as our intervention because the best available evidence that there was that there was some benefit conferred by plasma and some conferred by red blood cells. And when refill started, fresh frozen plasma only had a maximum 24-hour shelf life, which made it impossible to deliver and use on air ambulances who are obviously remote from hospitals. So we turned to freeze-dried lyophilized plasma, lyoplasm, as our plasma substitute.
And I think, as you allude to in that in your answer, this trial is quite different to many that we would normally publish in the haematology oncology setting, being done in an emergency setting. So can you tell us about how the treatments were given to patients and whether there were any interesting practical considerations for doing such a trial in this emergency setting?
Yes, it was about as difficult as a trial could get, I think, in that it was a fully prospective, randomised controlled trial, but it was delivered outside of the hospital setting, at the side of the road, often on a rainy Tuesday night at the side of a motorway, in patient group that was unable to consent to the trial because they were obviously in extremis at the time. The treatments were delivered from a sealed box, so the treating clinicians didn't know what was in the box when they enrolled the patient. They opened the box and it was either saline or red cells and plasma, and from then they were treated. But then the patients were then taken to hospitals remote from where the blood was issued, to a major trauma centre somewhere else in the country perhaps. So following up the patients then became very challenging. So with all of these aspects of the prospective randomised multi-centre trial with unconsenting patients using blood products and the Lyoplas, which at the time was an unlicensed medicinal product, it was very, very challenging to deliver this trial. And other than the obvious issues with COVID, the teams did an incredible job to keep recruitment on trajectory.
Great. That, bearing all that in mind, can you tell us about the main results from the trial?
Yeah, so our primary outcome was looking, as I said at the beginning, for increased survival or reduced mortality of our patients, but also accepting that the patients may live or die very remotely from the scene of the accident, having been through critical care, having been through several operations perhaps. It's very difficult to link what we did in the pre-hospital phase to a mortality 3-4 weeks hence. So we also looked at the quality of the resuscitation on arrival in the emergency department. And for that, we used lactate clearance as a measure of organ perfusion and oxygen delivery around the body. And with those two primary outcomes, there was no discernible difference between the intervention and saline. If you split the two primary outcomes, there is a small benefit seen in each, but when combined into a composite primary outcome, there is no benefit. The small benefit in the two individual components has a very, very large confidence interval, so it's very difficult to say whether or not that benefit exists. But looking at the traditional p-value, the only statistical significantly different result that we got was that the patients who arrived in hospital having had red blood cells had a higher hemoglobin. That was it. So overall mortality, days on critical care, infections, and obviously mortality, the confidence interval spanned zero.
Okay, and Gavin, if we move on to you now, you mentioned in the paper that the trial had to be stopped early because of disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you tell us more about how this happened and possible effects on the results of the trial?
Yes, so the trial spanned the COVID period. We've been running for about 3 or 4 years before the first wave of COVID came along. And I guess despite the valiant attempts of the ambulance services and the R&D infrastructure to continue to support the trial, that we faced two challenges, really. You know, first, the number of cases of major trauma dropped off massively. You know, people were needing to spend time locked down at home, and the sort of, fights, road traffic collisions that made up the case mix of patients, you know, those types of events weren't occurring. So there was a large reduction in the number of cases of major trauma. And then a combination of the R&D infrastructure and the NHS infrastructure that had been supporting the trial were redeployed to the clinical coalface in order to treat patients with COVID. So it led to us suspending the trial over several months. In terms of the impact of that, I guess that can be considered probably from two perspectives. You know, firstly, you know, do we think it's the effect of COVID is likely to have invalidated or somehow altered the results of the trial or affected the generalizability? And I think that's unlikely. I think there were relatively few patients recruited when the incidence of COVID was very high. And secondly, major trauma pathways. Whilst there have been many changes in the NHS, major trauma pathways and the network of major trauma centres and pre-hospital care systems remain pretty similar to how they were before. So I don't think it will have affected the generalisability of the study. But it did lead to us recruiting slightly less patients than we set out to in our original sample size calculation. We needed 438 patients with outcome data. We achieved 93% of that. So we didn't hit the recruitment target that we were aiming for. But as you'll see in the paper, our statistician John Bishop did a series of simulations to look at what happened if we continued to observe events at the same frequency in each of the arms and we increased the sample size. And those simulations went up to recruiting as many as 5,000 patients. And the point estimates, you know, really didn't alter, with the primary outcome as a composite of mortality and, you know, lactate clearance, you know, really wasn't going to change. And I guess in a sense, you know, that points to one of the challenges, you know, of that as a composite outcome, you know, for the trial, which, you know, Nick has already touched upon. I think, you know, future research will determine the, you know, the impact, you know, on some of the secondary outcomes. And I think, yeah, again, as Nick had highlighted, the point estimates for both mortality and lactate clearance were in the direction of favouring the intervention, you know, but the confidence intervals, you know, were still wide and included the possibility of both, you know, benefit and harm.
Yeah, so that's related to my next question, really, about future research in this area. So given that there wasn't a difference in the primary outcome, what do you think are the next steps in improving outcomes for these patients? And could you tell us what you think will be researched in the future related to products that can be given to patients in this setting?
Yeah, no, you know, very happy to, you know, respond to that. I think, you know, one of the first things, you know, probably is to think, you know, about the, you know, the groups of patients or potentially the indications, you know, for pre-hospital transfusion. I think we took as the inclusion criteria, you know, patients that were severely injured and patients that had clear evidence of, you know, hemorrhagic shock. But despite that, across the series of subgroup analyses, we were unable to identify any group of patients that seemed to have a pattern to suggest that they would, you know, benefit more or less from the intervention. So I think there probably needs to be some more exploratory, you know, work on, you know, identifying the group of patients who are most likely to benefit. And I think it was striking what a small proportion of patients in the saline group were actually anemic when they arrived at, you know, hospital. So I think some work on identifying the groups that, you know, may be most likely to benefit. I think the lack of a core outcome set for major trials of hemorrhagic shock in major trauma also hampers research in this field. We spent a long time discussing with investigators, with our study steering committee and with the funder as to what an optimal outcome would be for the study, noting that if one bases it solely on mortality, you need, you know, several, you know, hundreds going into thousands of patients, which potentially becomes impractical. I think with what we now know, that the primary outcome, our composite, you know, was limited in the insights that it gives us, despite I think it having a reasonable theoretical background at the point that it was selected. So I'd encourage people to conduct further research on identifying, you know, what should we be using as the outcomes for future trials in this field. And then I guess the third thing is thinking about developments in, you know, blood transfusion. I've heard there's a lot of interest at the moment in the UK and potentially in the US around whole blood transfusion. And there's the potential, I think, for a trial of that to start in the UK at some point in the future. So I think there's plenty still for us to learn about the role of blood and blood products. And identifying, you know, the patients that are potentially going to benefit the most from an intervention such as this.
You can read Professor Perkins and Dr. Crombie's research online now at thelancethematology.com. Thank you to Professor Perkins and Dr. Crombie, and thank you for listening to this episode of In Conversation With. Remember, you can subscribe to In Conversation With The Lancet Haematology wherever you usually get your podcasts.